Yeah, thanks Eberhard, and again, thanks to the organizers for inviting me here. This is my second presentation here, and the last one. And today I'll be talking about structure of turbulence in thick fluid layers. And in fact, this is an extension of the talk a colleague of mine, Hua Xia, has given in February, I believe, or early March. So probably none of you
was in the talk.
A few people
you
have heard.
Yeah.
So I'll take liberty of repeating some of the things she has said already and add new results. And the motivation for starting turbulent layers have several reasons. First, it's ubiquity of fluid layers in nature, where we deal with the turbulent systems whose depth is substantially less than the horizontal extent. And that brings up the idea of quasi-two-dimensionality of such flows, but by no means we know real flows are, strictly speaking, two-dimensional. And the second motivation was, of course, the discovery of very special properties of two-dimensional turbulence by Kreiknen and others, which gave us hope of understanding this subject maybe a bit better. But still, there are arguments about whether two-dimensional flows or turbulence, two-dimensional turbulence exists in nature or not, remain as active as ever. And I'll try addressing one of those questions by discussing our laboratory experiments. And in fact, the question is whether 2D flows in layers exist at all, or in other words, does two-dimensional turbulence exist? The second question I'm going to touch in this today in this talk, which factors affect turbulence dimensionality? So when we say two-dimensional or three-dimensional, what do we mean by this? And in particular, I'd like to say certainly there might be some three-dimensional motions present in the layer. Would this stop all the basic statistics of the two-dimensional turbulence, namely the inverse energy cascade? And that's the most important thing from the energy balance point of view. And thirdly, that's precisely this question we addressed recently. Does three-dimensionality or the presence of 3D motion stops the inverse energy cascade in fluid layers? Okay, I don't need to remind to this audience, but just for the sake of completeness, in 3D turbulence, force turbulence at large scales, and it cascades in isotropic homogeneous turbulence. It cascades down to Kolmogorov scale, where it is dissipated by viscosity, and the shape of the spectrum is K-5/3. Third order structure function is negative, reflecting the direction of the cascade, while in 2D turbulence, if it's forced at some intermediate scales corresponding to K injection in this case, entropy or the integral of the squared vorticity cascades down to smaller scales or higher wave numbers, while energy cascades towards larger scales, lower wave numbers. And if the bottom dissipation is present in the system, sooner or later the spectrum will stop, the inverse energy cascade will stop at some characteristic dissipative number, which depends on the level of the, say, bottom drag in the system. However, if the system, if the turbulence is bounded and the boundary box size is smaller than the inverse dissipative wave number, the energy may start piling up at the scale of the box and will end up having coherent flow, coherent across the domain. A few words about our experimental setup. We employ typically, there are two types of experiments of this kind where people study quasi-2D turbulence. Either these are falling soap films or electromagnetically driven turbulence in the relatively thin layers of electrolytes. we use electrolytes, and among the electrolytes there are two types of experiments. In one, the liquid metal, for example, mercury is placed in the homogeneous vertical magnetic field, and the flow is forced by inserting electrodes and driving vortices in the flow. In this case, two dimensionality is enforced by the magnetic field, and the dissipation is restricted to a very thin Hartmann layer, which is substantially smaller than the thickness of the layer. Such experiments were done many times, first by Samaria back in 1986. Majority of other experiments use layers of electrolyte placed into the spatially varying magnetic field, as shown here. This is actually the contour plot of the measured magnetic field that we generate using a matrix of 30 by 3900 magnetic dipoles, positive red, negative is blue, and when we run the current across the fluid cell J cross B, forces generate correspondingly 900 vortices which start interacting with each other. What happens then, I show. This is the vorticity field measured during the first couple of seconds after the current is switched on, and you see their forcing scale vortices. Forcing scale vortices are determined by scale. Forcing scale is determined by the distance between the magnets. In some cases, we place a heavier immiscible fluid at the bottom and the conducting electrolyte on top of it, which is lighter, to isolate, to reduce bottom damping. How we visualize the flow, place imaging particles and use either standard PAV technique, or in this example I show to sometimes to get larger spatial resolution, we use two lasers, different colors, which are triggered twice during the exposure time of the high resolution camera, and by doing this we sometimes capable of employing just a high resolution still camera. Still, the distance between the two laser pulses gives us can be adjusted to match the velocities that we need. To visualize the flow in the said direction, we sometimes just use a vertical laser slab and illuminate imaging particles and film them from the side. The other technique that we use to characterize motion in 3D is the so-called defocus particle image velocimetry, where we use a single camera, and inside the camera between the lens and the image plane or the CCD sensor of the camera, we put a mask with three small holes, such that when the imaging particles is located at the reference plane somewhere here, it is imaged into the image plane as a single point. However, any deviation of the particle away in the vertical direction brings up these triangles, and the size of the triangle is proportional to the distance from the reference plane. And in that case, we use our PAV PTV particle tracking velocimetry hybrid to track the motion of the triangles, and that gives us the third component of the velocity. Okay, so what is spectral condensation? Spectral condensation, as I said, is formation of a large structure. First couple of seconds after we turn the current on, we observe forcing scale vortices. Soon after that, we see those vortices merging and aggregating into larger structures. And if the bottom dissipation is sufficiently low, this is the most essential parameter for the condensation, we observe the formation of a single large-scale vortex, which then exists in the steady state in such a flow. In experiments by Samaria in Mercury, he reported they didn't turn off the power supply for a week and the large structure was still there. However, since that early observation, very little had been done in studying spectrally condensed turbulence. So how does it look in an experiment? This is just a movie of what our box sky average movie of what our camera sees. You see that forcing scale vortices disappear and give way to some larger scale vortices which don't live for too long, and eventually they merge together, and you see the onset of the large circulation over the box size. And if the damping is lower, the lower the damping, the more symmetric and the more pronounced this flow is.
So there's no remaining feature of the magnetic field? I mean, you cannot see that there could be...
In the corners.
Only the corners?
Yeah, you see the corner vortices is still surviving.
You couldn't tell?
It shears them off. Basically.
Just really off, yeah. So you couldn't see that there's a little wiggling?
We still can see it after we subtract the mean.
And then you see it?
Yeah, okay. When we do that.
So it's still there? Okay.
They're still there, yeah.
No, I mean, they're still detectable, because you would think they have to follow a little bit of mechanics.
They are detectable, but there are two effects which destroy them. First, shearing, and the second, sweeping. So basically, the large-scale flow sweeps them away from the position of the magnet, and the interaction, the energy injection is reduced due to this. Okay, so next question. How thick is a thick layer? And so we've done many experiments in thin layers, and the movie I showed that was in thin layers, and since Perrey, Tebeling, Samaria, no one really questioned whether spectra are minus 503 and whether the inverse cascade is there. The question was, what is thick and what is thin, and whether you can apply any of these concepts to any other options. And until recently, it was kind of a difficult question. Last year, Chilani and others have undertaken 3D DNS calculations and studied exactly this point. They gradually increased the thickness of the layer. This is their normalized inverse energy cascade flux, inverse here, negative, and it's gradually, as the thickness of the layer is increased, the inverse cascade is reduced and the direct cascade goes up. So basically, it's like switching the direction of the energy injection from the inverse to the direct. And by the time they got to the thickness, where the layer thickness was half of the forcing scale, practically nothing was seen in the inverse cascade, and most of it was in the direct cascade. In the spectrum, this minus 503 range corresponds to the inverse cascade, while with the increased thickness, there was a growing range of minus 503 due to the direct cascade. So the expectation from this result...
What is it in between this amazing
flux? This is minus 3, I guess. That's a surviving bit of the entropy, okay. Direct entropy cascade. And the conclusion was that the paper was called Turbulence Between 2 and 3 Dimensions, or something like that. And indeed, the 2D and 3D can coexist in some regimes. So we were trying to reproduce or to check these results, and we started working with the thicker layers. These are velocity profiles. Are the results of defocused particle PAV. This is the layer thickness and VZ. And when the thickness of the layer was 0.2 of their forcing scale, that's basically our technique resolution, so I wouldn't take these points too seriously. It's about 0.4, that's the minimal Z velocity we resolve. However, when we go to thicker layers, 0.6, we measure substantially higher velocities, and VZ appears to be higher and higher. These are particle streaks taken in the Z-Y plane, to visualize vertical eddies, and this flow is reasonably planar. You don't see any substantial 3D vortices while above 0.5 thickness. Clearly, 3D motions are present there. And they reach 30, sometimes 50% VZ, RMS VZ, goes to 0.3, 0.4 of the RMS of horizontal velocities. So how we can quantify the flow to dimensionality? We are not arguing that 3D motions are present in the flow, but can we invent a parameter which will give us the answer? And the answer is we can do this by measuring the flow damping rate. Okay, in the quasi-two-dimensional flow, one estimates their decay rate by using a diffusion type or heat equation, which relates dvx horizontal over dt. This is kinematic viscosity, and the second derivative of the horizontal velocity over z. And with the boundary conditions, zero velocity at the bottom and zero gradients close to the free surface, you can find the this pretty good estimate, actually, of the decay rate, exponentially decaying rate of the flow, which can be measured, can be tested in experiments. We measure, actually, the decay of the energy, such that the decay constant here, alpha L, is twice this theoretical lambda, and you see that it's reasonably exponential, and in fact, in thin layers, we find a reasonably good agreement with this, value. However, in thicker layers, in the presence of these strong eddies, we expect that these three eddies would affect damping via eddy viscosity, and the eddy viscosity is due to the vertical flux of the horizontal momentum, which can be characterized by some coefficient k. This is the correlator is just the Reynolds stress and dvxy over dz. So in principle, we measure all of these parameters, and then we can estimate k from our defocused PAV measurements. That's what we have done, and this is the data we use to estimate k. This is vz profiles and vxy profiles. And then we can introduce some viscous plus turbulent dissipation by adding k to the to the kinematic viscosity. And this is the expected anomaly coefficient. We introduce this anomaly coefficient alpha, measured normalized by alpha quasi 2D.
Is a mu any more comparable to the
eddy viscosity? Mm-hmm. In our case, yes. In our case, you can see a ratio of 1 corresponds basically to the dominance of the molecular viscosity, and we go up to 6-7, so which means they're in the same ballpark here.
Is that because the layer is not thick enough, the turbulence level is not very high?
Mostly because we work with reasonably low Reynolds numbers. Mm-hmm. I'm not extrapolating any of these results to very high Reynolds. And the measured, the actual measured anomaly in the dissipation.
What's the Reynolds number actually?
About 100.
RE or
Taylor scale, about 50-80.
50-80.
Okay, so we observe this anomaly coefficient, which is the ratio of the actual measured divided by this theoretically predicted, and one would correspond to quasi-2D limit, and indeed with the thickness of the layer of the order of 0.2, 0.3, we are pretty good in terms of quasi-2D approximation, though the damping here is huge. Just viscous damping is huge. However, when we go to thicker layers, this anomaly goes up. Practically, it means still the damping goes down. It just we expected it to go down as 1 over h squared, and it goes down like 1 over h. But this coefficient alpha is practically useful because we don't have to measure anything. It's much easier to measure the damping rate compared with all 3D components. So if you want a cheap method of guessing whether it's 2D or 3D, just measure the damping rate. Just look at the movie and count. Okay, so actually this plot appeared to be quite useful because we started adding points to it, and then we discovered that this approximately straight line, this is anomaly damping versus the thickness of the layer, normalized layer thickness, goes up. However, it's not working for double layers when we have electrolyte on top of the heavy fluid. And it also doesn't work in the case where we impose large-scale flow externally onto the flow. I'll talk more about this experiment later on. But overall, this measure of three-dimensionality as an anomaly damping works as a good starting point. So which flows are quasi-2D? a very thin single layers like this point. So basically between one and two anomaly, that the majority of the experiments we found in the literature fall into this in this box. Secondly, single layers with large scale imposed flows. I'll talk more about this, and double layer configurations. And I'll ask this question: why these double layers and single layers with imposed flow behave as quasi 2D despite being thick layers, and they are substantially thicker than the numerics are telling us they should be. Okay, that's a recent paper was published this month in Nature Physics. And the answer to the question why thick double layers behave as quasi-2D is due to self-imposed planarity. We generate this configuration, a non-conducting layer 4 millimeters thick, and on top of it 7 millimeters thick electrolyte. Forcing scale is about 8 or 9 millimeters. The ratio is here, 0.8. So by all means, that's a thick layer. And indeed, when we turn the current on, we observe in the horizontal plane, these are particle streaks, in the horizontal plane, and here's in the vertical plane. And you see plenty of vertical motions, plenty of 3D motion in this case. If we wait long enough, 20 seconds afterwards, we see the formation of the large condensate, which is indicative of the inverse energy cascade. And in the vertical plane, we see that the flow has become reasonably planar. So 3D flow develops into quasi-2D.
That was the boundary conditions are important.
Boundary conditions are important. We kept the boundary.
I mean that otherwise you wouldn't need the liquid underneath. I mean the vertical.
Oh yeah.
The boundary condition.
To reduce damping, nothing else.
Just to reduce damping.
Because damping kills the.
But the boundary condition is also different. I mean for the flow, right? You don't have a zero velocity boundary condition.
At the bottom?
At the bottom of your viscous layer.
Yes.
It's slowing with the liquid, right?
Yes.
Probably at a slower speed, but...
Yeah. I'll talk more about the structure in the vertical direction. All right, so the question is, if it's quasi-2D, then it should show the inverse energy cascade. If we measure the spectrum, that's how the spectrum looks in the presence of the large-scale condensate in steady state, and this huge peak at low K is the large flow, and there is a hint of minus 5 over 3, well, pretty good hint, but it is short. The injection wave number is here, this is the condensate wave number, and the third-order structure function is incomprehensible. It's not linear, it's negative, it means nothing. However, if we calculate the mean, if we compute the mean velocity, averaged over tens of seconds or several hundreds of instantaneous velocity fields, compute mean and then subtract that mean from all individual instantaneous fields and do the analysis again, we recover pretty good minus 5 over 3 over the entire range in the inverse energy cascade. Even something steeper than minus 3 in the enstrophy cascade. And most importantly, S3 becomes linear and positive, which is a good indication of the inverse energy cascade. The mean subtraction actually is just the fact pollutes the higher order moments due to terms like this one. So even in the velocity differences, we have a contribution now from the velocity fluctuations and from the mean flow. One could think that it only would affect large-scale flows, but in reality, for example, for the third order moment, these two terms will average down to zero, but these terms won't average. Mm-hmm. And they will start polluting even at smaller scales. So it's not safe to keep the flow, and perhaps that's something well known, but it can confuse
So what are you saying? You just subtract the mean?
We subtract the mean and then we recover something reasonable, yeah. And we subtract, after subtracting the mean, we always check if the energy flux derived from S3 agrees with the energy balance, and the energy balance can be established in the decay or during the startup. And surprisingly, even in the presence of such a huge vortex, which definitely changes turbulence from isotropic to strongly anisotropic, on average, box average, gives us a reasonably good agreement with the Kolmogorov flux relation.
That's what we do. So in the French washing machine 3D, that's what we do. We always subtract the large scale flow. How long do you have to average?
The longer the better. The longer the better, but the averaging is difficult. In numerical simulations, they also notice this problem, but in numerics, they usually observe a dipole which rotates in the box, and you have to subtract this rotating box, so then you have to do some tricks, yeah. Okay, so we established that mean flow modifies velocity moments, and we just have to subtract it. Okay, now we decided let's remove the condensate, because we suspect the condensate is responsible for imposing this quasi-two-dimensionality on the layer, and we removed the boundary. We made the biggest boundary we could, something like 30 by 30 centimeters, the cell size, and we decided instead of the condensate, we impose externally just a large vortex by bringing a large magnetic dipole from the top. When we do this, it generates a vortex like that, now externally imposed. Then we remove the magnet and observe the flow evolution. So turbulence is being forced all the time. Then we add large vortex and observe what happens during the decay of the vortex, not of the turbulence, but of the vortex. Initially, before the magnet was brought in, we see the standard picture 3D motion. Soon after, 1 second after the large vortex was introduced, we see pretty much planar flow all over the cross section, and then 3D eddy starts showing up, starting from the bottom. And after a while, after about 15 seconds, we get more back to this picture. So the conclusion was, yes, the imposition of the large-scale flow reduces substantially VZ component of the velocity and brings the flow back. So it's in case of the condensate, it's like the large-scale vortex imposes three-dimensionality to secure its own food supply, because it is fed by the inverse energy cascade, and it suppresses 3D. Decreases its own damping. It doesn't need as much food any longer with the planar flow, plus it secures the inverse cascade. So we decided to check their horizontal statistics now again in a single layer, in this case top line, we have fairly flat spectrum, much flatter than minus 403, because turbulent damping stops the cascade. And that is seen from the S3 result. S3 is positive, but it's not really much to write home about because it's so small. Soon after we impose large-scale flow, and this is seen here, we subtract mean and we recover reasonably good minus 403, and again, we observe fairly good positive S3, which means that the inverse energy cascade is back. What is it back due to remains a question. It could be due to the fact that we simply reduced the damping, and we did. By imposing the large flow, the flow has become planar. We switched off 3D eddies, and the damping is lower. That could be one reason. Another reason could be, like theory tells us, it could be that the energy used to be redirected in the direct cascade, and now it's back to the inverse cascade. But we don't see that. We don't see any signatures of the direct cascade in our experiment.
Can you parameterize with some quantification on the strength of the imposed flow?
Yes. It's the strength of the imposed flow, yes. Basically, you could see in the decay, like here. That's the strongest flow, and this is slightly
in the decay. Yeah.
In the decay, but we can do these experiments in steady state as well.
Yeah.
All right. So the question is, to start this condensate in the first place, we needed some residual or inverse cascade flux to start with, and then we can speculate that the large-scale flow sheared off all the vertical eddies in the layer, reinforced planarity, and we got what we got. Yeah, but how and whether we have such a flux, that's the question we asked recently, and the answer is kind of yes. We looked into the profiles of the vertical and horizontal velocity, 10 millimeter layer, forcing is 8 millimeter, so we are 1.2, the thickness of the layer is 1.2 of the forcing scale, thick layer no doubt. At the bottom is zero. We watch carefully that our free surface is never perturbed, so that VZ on the free surface is zero. And this is the profile of the horizontal velocity. You see no gradient, of the horizontal close to the free surface, and this is a shear layer. So I would expect that somewhere first top 2 millimeters should behave as quasi 2D. So we decided to check this by illuminating these layers using three different laser slabs, illuminating 8 to 10 millimeters and measuring the horizontal statistics of the flow, then the bulk sublayer roughly from 4 to 7 millimeters and the bottom sublayer from 1 to 3 millimeters. And the results are as follows. First, at the surface layer, as one would expect, because it's reasonably quasi 2D, we observe beautiful K minus 503, even with a slight hint of slightly steeper. Maybe it may start condensing sometime soon. Signature of the entropy cascade, nice and positive and linear S3, which is indicative of the inverse cascade. Actually, just a historical remark, first experiments in 2D layers were performed by Perry and Tebling, and our group did this, followed the same idea or mistake. We just placed particle on top on the surface. They were not properly suspended within the volume. We just used particles which were slightly lighter than the rest, and they were floating. I can, if you want to make a good student experiment to illustrate what 2D turbulence is, you guaranteed, if your surface is not perturbed, you guaranteed to reproduce 2D turbulence on the layer, always, regardless of 3D or 2D underneath. Because if it's not perturbed, VZ is zero, and if there are no substantial gradients, there is infinitely small or thicker or thinner layer always will be present there, where the flow will be 2D. The rest may be 3D as much as it wants.
What that means is a lot, that on the top you get a large scale flow pattern, which is...
You may get...
While below it's turbulent, but on the top you might get some kind of...
You have inverse, larger structures on the top, and it could be something different underneath. And then, that's what I'm getting at, there could be a competition. Because if you have a large scale flow, it may try to suppress three-dimensionality underneath.
But Michael, you've got to suppress
it in surface motion. We just avoid. We don't suppress it, though it's possible. We're thinking about putting a transparent piece of glass on top and force harder.
Yeah.
We just don't force as hard to avoid the surface perturbation, especially in thin layers. It's quite easy to disturb the surface.
As soon as you disturb the surface, then it's over.
Well, it's kind of will look as a compressible flow.
Yeah, there's experiments where people, you know, we put one experiment too, where you produce turbulence in the bulk with some mixers,
mm-hmm.
and then you look at the air interface, and so you're saying that interface actually produces turbulence. Although you drive very strong turbulence underneath, if you don't get much in surface deformations, it might actually, you put floaters on it.
Yeah.
You know, Walter Goldberg has done a lot of experiments where he has made turbulence underneath and looked at floaters.
Yeah.
So these floaters might actually behave more two-dimensionally than the flow might actually be total turbulence on the surface.
Yes.
An inverse cascade, which you wouldn't see in the bulk.
So when we illuminate the bulk, between 4-7 millimeters, and you see that the spectrum shows the sign of the flattening towards larger scale, and the S3 is still positive, but it saturates at shorter separation distances, about 3 to 4 millimeters, and finally, when we get to the bottom, the spectrum is reasonably flat, much flatter than minus 503, and you still can, if you look at all three of them, you can imagine what's going on. It's damping. The closer to the bottom, the higher the damping, and this damping basically kills the inverse cascade. But the shocking thing for us was to discover that the...
So these are 2D layers.
The flow is trying to send energy to larger scales via the inverse cascade in the situation where there's intense 3D motion going on. All right, and then that brings up probably a plausible model that if the thickness of the layer is sufficient, or if the damping, I shouldn't be saying thickness, if the damping is sufficiently low and we allow for condensation to occur in the top layer, this condensate may start suppressing three-dimensionality underneath. And it's a constant competition who wins, 3D turbulence underneath or the top layer, which is always 2D. Okay, so this is just a summary of the previous one. During the first 5 seconds, it's 3D and turbulent, and this is condensed and planar. And we measured profiles of the VZ in double layers. This is non-conducting layer up to zero, and 0 to 7 millimeters. First 5 seconds corresponding to this case, we observe substantial 3D motions, and VZ goes up to 1.5 millimeters per second here, and in this case it is reduced 15 seconds after to down to our resolution of the technique. In the horizontal plane, it has horizontal velocity is maximum right above the interface. In this case, this is non-conducting, so forcing is zero here. This maximum corresponds to the maximum of forcing because B decreases as 1/1 distance from the magnets, away from the magnets. And that just reflects the fact that the forcing is the strongest here. When this large flow develops, it shifts this point towards lower, and that's probably due to sweeping or reduction in the forcing scale vortices. While the condensate develops in steady state and shows practically no gradient close to the free surface. And that's where it leaves ever after with this kind of profile. So their preliminary answers to those questions I asked in the beginning, that turbulence seems to remain quasi-2D even in 3D layers. The second conclusion, that the planarity of flows in thick layers may be self-imposed by condensing turbulence. This seems to be the case in double layers, and we haven't achieved yet, but we'll try harder to achieve condensed turbulence in a single layer. Probably we should reach this limit where it will become possible, because the damping still goes down with the increase in the thickness, and sooner or later there is a hope that the top layer may win and do the job. And third conclusion is that the final state of the flow results from the competition between quasi-2D top sublayer and the bulk flow. And just for the illustration, I want to show this diagram. So our understanding how this 2D, 3D turbulence worked initially was represented by these blue arrows. So this is forcing. We inject energy depending on the layer thickness, either into the inverse cascade and form 2D turbulence, or in 3D terms, so that 3D turbulence, and that brings up the direct cascade. But in the presence of the boundary, it may start condensing into large-scale flow. This flow starts affecting forcing, and it starts affecting the spectrum as such. And then we found that the bottom dissipation kicks in as we increase the thickness of the layer. That brings up 3D motions, VZ. VZ generates increased bottom dissipation and affects both of these cascades if they're present. In principle, even higher level of forcing, I didn't touch this and didn't show the results, brings up shear driven instabilities, and some additional 3D rolls appear in the boundary layer and propagate, are injected into the flow from the boundary. And in addition, the condensate also, apart from the just shear suppression of 2D turbulence, condensate suppresses 3D motion and basically generates this feedback loop, which secures planarity and 3D condensate in this case. Yeah, so that's basically what I wanted to show today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, what is the Taylor microscale compared to thickness of your supplier?
I can't tell.
Well, the Orlando was what? Up 80?
About 80, yeah.
It should be able to calculate. It must be quite large. I mean, the Komogorovsky must be quite large, right?
Komogorovsky is 0.2 millimeter.
0.2 millimeters?
Komogorov is 0.2 millimeters, yes. So it's still you might have correlations in the flow.
To the Komogorov.
Across the whole. The whole
is 10 millimeters, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the Taylor microscale is what are 50 to 100 Komogorov scales, something like that?
Yeah.
So you might have several millimeters. So it might actually be almost the size of it. So there might be correlations.
Yeah, actually, there is no magic.
Surely, I mean, the energy change has to be larger.
Yeah. Absolutely. We just don't allow any scales substantially larger than the forcing scale to be three-dimensional. They're forced to be 2D. That's why.
That's right. So the forcing scale cuts it off too.
Yeah. As long as we allow it.
That's an interesting turbulence, right? Because the energy injection scale is fixed to be whatever. What is it?
Slightly above. Forcing scale is half of the thickness, roughly. Or slightly smaller than that.
Have you measured the indicator length scale?
No.
Interesting to know what comes out, how big it actually is.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Any other questions?
Mm.
So, this is very nice. Thank you very much.